Before we get going, here's the bit where I remind you that nothing we discussed should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets. And now, on with the show. Welcome, everybody, to another edition of the Grant Williams Podcast. Joining me today, I'm delighted to say, is John Ellis, the author of a letter on a Substack called News Items, which is a fascinating set of letters. John has a background, which he'll explain shortly, in mainstream media, working with News Corp for Rupert Murdoch on a series of special projects, and his pedigree is extraordinary. We had a time squeeze here, as you'll hear, but we will continue this conversation at a later date because it was such a fascinating one for me, and I feel like there's so much more to get into with John. But as an introduction to him, his career, his writing, and his thinking, I can't think of anything better. So without further ado, please enjoy my conversation with John Ellis. Well, John, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast. I'm delighted we found some time to chat and to get a chance to talk with you.
Thank you very much for having me, Brent.
Well, let's just kick off with a kind of brief potted bio so people listening who aren't familiar with your work get a sense of how you got to where you are. And then there's a whole bunch of stuff I'd love to dig into with you.
Thank you very much for having me on the program. I really appreciate it. A quick background would be I've been in the media business for almost 50 years. I was a political analyst for NBC News. I was a columnist for the Boston Globe. I wrote columns for a number of other publications. The last 3 years of working for a company was 2016 to 2019. I worked for Rupert Murdoch at News Corp doing special projects. And one of the projects that I did there was a newsletter, which we called News Items. And that covered what we said was news that was interesting, important, or both. The newsletter covers four subject areas. A world in disarray is one. The financialization of everything is two. Advances in science and technology is three. And geopolitics, both foreign and domestic, is four. That's the sort of menu of the newsletter. And when I was working at News Corp, the newsletter was called the Wall Street Journal CEO Council Morning Brief. After I left News Corp, the next day, I started News Items as a separate independent newsletter and signed up with Substack, which is a publishing platform, and we went to a paid subscription model in August of 2019. We now have three newsletters: News Items, which is daily, 6 days a week; Political Items, which is three times a week and focuses largely on U.S. politics, but also foreign politics. And then a weekly publication called Bird News Items, which is actually done by my brother and focuses on all of the interesting, important, or both stories about birds. So that's a sort of quick background.
Terrific. Well, the essay that caught my attention was the essay you wrote about the code, which I guess maybe was probably January of this year or February this year, early 2023, I think. Mm-hmm. And I found that absolutely fascinating. I'd love to get you to talk about that in a second because it crystallized a lot of things that I've been thinking, not in that actual way, but the broad sense of that article about the inequality in the world is something that I've spent an awful lot of time thinking about. Not just the fact that it exists, but the fact that its obsolescence has become the aim of everybody in every walk of life and the impossibility of eradicating inequality. I struggle with it because it means that everybody is trying to do something that's impossible instead of trying to work out what the best thing they can do is to solve a problem. They're trying to solve an insolvable problem and throwing resources at it, which ultimately you could probably steward much better and get a better effect from targeting those resources. But your angle on the code, the kind of twist towards the end, really got me thinking. So I don't want to be the guy to take the veil off that because it was such a powerful thought. So why don't I let you run through the code essay and then we'll kind of dig into what it means.
Well, I've been thinking a lot, as you have, about inequality and the impact of inequality on our culture, our society. And the one that everybody talks about in politics is income inequality, And Thomas Piketty wrote a book about it, and it's sort of in intellectual circles, academic circles, it's sort of de rigueur to bemoan income inequality. And there's a segment of the academic intellectual elite group that thinks that's the big issue. The progressive wing of the Democratic Party thinks that's the big issue. Nobody else really does. Jeff Bezos made billions of dollars building a great company. Good for him. He's going to pay more taxes, and eventually he's going to have so much money, he's going to have to figure out a way to give it all away. So it's not really a problem. There's a second view, which is the major problem, is social inequality. The meritocracy has created a class of people. This is overstated, but it's created a class of people who think they're better than other people. And that this social inequality has become much more pervasive in U.S. and indeed Western societies than we could ever imagine. My father-in-law, working class guy from Bayonne, New Jersey, served in the United States Navy in World War II in the Pacific Theater. His bunkmate on the USS Buckley was a man named Ames, who came from the richest family in the state of Massachusetts. Every time that my father-in-law came to visit my wife and I in Dedham, Massachusetts, when we lived there, he always went over to Mr. Ames's house and they had dinner. No one was better than the other one. They were equals. They had served in the Navy together and so on and so forth. That changed dramatically as the baby boom aged, essentially. So you have social inequality, which is, I think, that's a really corrosive problem, and certainly in the United States. But the big one, the one that really stands out to me, is what I call code inequality, which is there are 8 billion people in the world. If we say expansively that there are 2 million people who know how to write the algorithms of artificial intelligence, then whatever that percentage is, those are the people who control the future of humanity, essentially. And the rest of us, 7.999999 billion of us, are powerless.
So let's talk about that, because I'd never thought about it before, and before I read the essay, and I can't stop thinking about it since, because obviously after you wrote that, the timing was perfect for the arrival of ChatGPT, for example, to come along and become something in everybody's lives that initially everybody marveled at, and then everybody started worrying about, and then eventually most people have forgotten about already, right? Because it just became, like everything does, a little plaything for a while and everyone was amazed by it, and now it's gone away. But that having been unleashed, these large language models, all the broad and narrow artificial intelligence that we're being bombarded with every day, just reinforces that point you've made, that for the vast majority of us, the ability to code is non-existent unless we can learn to kind of harness something like ChatGPT to write it for us, perhaps. But when you go through your thought process around this coding inequality, where does it go? Where does that path lead, do you think?
I'm not sure, because it was captured, I thought, perfectly at the meeting in the Codehouse in Great Britain, where the tech people and the prime ministers and Vice President Harris and so on and so forth showed up to discuss guardrails for artificial intelligence. And the contrast was so astonishing. You have these tech people who knew the subject matter inside out, and you had the political people who knew nothing of the subject other than they should talk about it because they read that it was dangerous. But in theory, Vladimir Putin famously said, he who controls artificial intelligence will rule the world. And so the question really is what consortium of people are going to either harness the power of artificial intelligence to rule the world, or will they themselves rule the world? I have no idea what the answer to that is, but the one thing about it that's absolutely true is with enough electricity and broadband connection, AI masters, if you will, can work anywhere, be anywhere, have no need to be in Palo Alto or Cambridge, Massachusetts, or Zurich or Singapore.
When I followed that down, there's one or two things that stands out to me as potential passes. One, as you say, governments and nation states will absolutely pander to these people because they want them inside the tent. They want them in their jurisdiction. They want the tax revenues that their operations will bring. And the other potential is they're so terrified of something they don't understand that they over-regulate it, they over-legislate, and they kind of try and strangle the thing at birth, or at least put some very strong government arms around this technology to make sure it doesn't do things that they don't want. And I don't think either of those solutions is a practical one. And we've seen in the last several years, you know, the rise in power of the Silicon Valley elite has been extraordinary. You know, barely a day goes by without a picture of a prime minister here or there in a photo op with Elon Musk or Bezos or any of these guys. Do you think that the recent goings on in the crypto space, particularly with the high profile trial of Sam Bankman-Fried, does that change the quantum here for leaders cozying up to, I'm using air quotes here, to tech bros? Because there is a danger that because of this stuff is unproven, that they turn out to be perhaps people you shouldn't take political donations for or have your picture slathered all over the press glad-handing.
I think the political class will happily take tech money. You know, Democrats now have three major sources of big money, dark money, whatever you want to call it. There's Hollywood, the creative industry, if you will. There's finance, where that sprung up because of the fear of Trump. And then the most important piece right now is the tech community. So I can't imagine that they'll say, gee, maybe we shouldn't take money from them. I think that Reid Hoffman walks into their office and says, I want to contribute $25 million to this PAC. I think they'll say, here's the checking account number. So the thing that's different, crypto, because it was disconnected from the full faith and power of the U.S. government or whatever underwrites the U.S. dollar, that was always iffy. And there was always the sense around it that it needed to be upgraded professionally, let's put it that way. And a lot of people thought that Mark Zuckerberg would do that when Facebook talked about doing Libra as a cyber currency or a cryptocurrency, which I still think would have been enormously successful, but that's another issue. But in the case of AI, we're way past any doubt about whether it works, whether it's effective, whether it's real. It's absolutely real, and it has this enormous potential for good, as we see in the protein folding work that's been done by DeepMind, and it has this enormous capacity to do terrible things, which we can imagine. One would be to cook up viruses that can be unleashed to destroy populations.
As you've covered this and as you talked about it, what's been the trajectory in terms of the reaction to people? How has that followed through along this kind of wonderment to fear to, in many cases, disinterest now? How's that played out?
You can get your arms around the financial crisis of 2008. You can put the pieces together. This is how it happened. These are the bad actors. These are the mistakes that were made, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The problem with AI is that we have no idea how it works. And we may talk to people who know how it works, but even when we talk to them, we still don't know how it works. We have a general idea of how large language models piece together the information and spit it back to us, but we have no idea how it's done. And so there's three reactions: be terrified, be enormously optimistic about the possibilities. And the third one, which seems to me to be the most prevalent, is I just don't get it, so I'm going to shut down.
It's impossible now to have a discussion about anything without someone bringing up, well, AI, this. AI is going to change all that. You know, it seems to me to be getting a little bit out of hand that people see it as the solution. And even now, as a solution, once AI is offered, that's the end of the conversation. It's, well, you know, we're going to use AI to do all this. And we're going to use AI, and don't worry, we're going to bring in AI and fold it in. And it just seems to me like such a blanket buzzword that you can just cite AI now and everybody's going to go, oh, AI, well, this is going to be great.
In my experience, so I get out of News Corp, I start this newsletter, I get some traction, get subscribers, I decide to raise some money to add staff, so on and so forth. The legal costs for setting up the corporation that owns news items and political items were, I think, $35,000. And the accounting costs for doing everything, employee payroll and the tax, all that stuff, I'm guessing is like $22,000 a year. If I had what will be available in 3 years, which is essentially AI legal services, AI accounting services, those two bills likely would be $5,000 for legal and maybe $3,500 for accounting. So if you cast that across every small business in the United States of America, there's a reason that people say AI all the time. It's because it's going to dramatically change the business models of every small company, every startup, everything, not just here, but all around the world. Jeff Katzenberg was at a conference somewhere yesterday, I guess a Bloomberg thing. And he said that he thought the cost of doing a full feature length animated movie was X, and that it took 3 to 5 years to do a really good one. He said with AI, the cost and the time will be reduced by 90%, 90%. I mean, that's what the strike was all about in Hollywood, was AI. And you can see why. Is AI going to transform sports? I certainly don't think so, but it will absolutely transform legal, accounting, creative industries, creative businesses, and science. So it's going to have a major impact on 80 to 90% of the economic activity around the world.
But the implications for that from a government perspective, obviously, in terms of tax revenues are horrendous. This is an absolute nightmare for them. If we're going to dramatically cut costs, we're going to dramatically reduce workforces. What's the angle for governments and tax collectors around this thing?
As you say, you're talking about the need for, at my law firm, the legal work for news items, there were three people who worked on it. Obviously, it could be a half person plus the AI. So if you multiply that out across every business, et cetera, the loss of tax revenue is half. So the question is, what do you do? And I have no idea, frankly. But the one thing I do know is that the Social Security Trust Fund is nearing bankruptcy, and the Medicare Trust Fund is nearing bankruptcy, and AI is going to take away a lot of jobs. It may create a lot of jobs. We certainly hope so. But it's not exactly the best time to be reducing tax revenue.
No, it's not. And this plays into a couple of the other streams of your newsletter, and that is a world in disarray and the financialization of everything. And I'm fascinated to pull on that second thread, because you were very much in the belly of the mainstream beast with News Corp. There isn't a more mainstream media organization than News Corp anywhere in the world. And yet this idea of the financialization of everything as a threat, really, to many things, is not something that really I ever saw got much coverage. You know, it was really more alternative media that spoke about that. And even then, more from people who had extensive experience in the financial world and could see what was actually happening from the inside. You know, I'm not sure that the average man in the street understands what the financialization of everything means. So to talk a little bit, if you can, about that as an idea, about the reception it got, and how you went about explaining that concept to a mainstream audience.
Well, I first read the word financialization in a book by Kevin Phillips, who was the legendary Republican political strategist who did the Nixon Southern strategy in 1968. He went on to become a sort of leftish wing populist, and he was appalled by the rise of the influence of Wall Street and what he called the financial class. And he made the point way back when that what was happening in the U.S. economy was the, quote, financialization of everything. So that's where the phrase came from. The traditional services that were offered by investment banks and traditional banks and the original venture capital people were heavily regulated. If you were an investment banker, you couldn't be part of retail banking. The Glass-Steagall Act had built guardrails to keep things from getting out of control. The Clinton administration discarded the Glass-Steagall Act, and thus what was ushered in thereafter was the financialization ball. And what rose out of that was what we now call alternative investing. Alternative investing is hedge funds, private equity funds, private credit funds, certain kinds of venture capital. And all of that now comprises an enormously large part of the financial world and is everywhere. If you drive up Route 95 in Connecticut, the chances are that the gas stations you see on either side of the highway are owned by a private equity group. When private equity started, really started with KKR and those companies at the forefront, what they did was they went into companies that were terribly run, wildly underperforming, needed to be cleaned up and brought up to speed. These private equity firms would come in, they would do just that. The companies would thrive, they would take the companies public, and everybody was happy. Somewhere along the way, those kind of deals ran out. And what private equity has now become is essentially you buy a company, you lay along just enormous amounts of debt, you fire as many people as you possibly can, you hope that you can take it public. It's a completely different model than the original idea. And now there are, I can't remember the numbers, but they're like 15 or 20,000 private equity companies around the world with literally trillions of dollars to put to work. And we put our dogs at a daycare for dogs place, and you can't think of a more local small business, and turns out it's owned by private equity. So you've had this enormous shift in terms of financial services going to these private enterprises that are untransparent, if you say, you want to say, or opaque to all of us, and they are wielding ever, ever greater power. So that's the sort of long-winded answer to how I see financialization as a, more as a political issue, really, than as a financial issue. And I think we're very close to private equity being a major political issue.
Well, it's funny because I've had conversations in this podcast with other people about this. And as I've watched the rise of AI, and I read your article about coding and the few people that understand it, the thing that occurred to me as I was reading it was that this idea of financialization of everything, I would argue potentially, certainly right now, is more dangerous than AI, because AI, there is a mystique about it and people understand it comes with coding and computers, which a lot of people just don't understand or certainly aren't native in. Whereas the financial industry is something that an awful lot of people believe they understand. People believe they understand how the financial system works, and they understand the, how the bank works. And yet, if you ask people what a fractional reserve system was, they wouldn't have the first idea and wouldn't be able to explain it to you. And so I've long thought that this idea of financialization of everything is potentially catastrophic, particularly if and when we reach the point we've reached now, where this tailwind that financialization has had of falling interest rates for 40 years turns all the demons and all the stuff that's hidden away in those private equity firms that don't work without an ever-decreasing cost of capital are going to be revealed. And once they are, the loss of value is going to impact people who have absolutely no idea that they are prone and susceptible to an about-face in the private equity business. What are your thoughts on that?
I couldn't agree with you more. We had however many years it was, essentially zero interest rates, and all sorts of novel financial ideas came tumbling out of the box. And you were able to do it because the interest rate was zero, right? So it was free money. And so you could lay on hundreds of millions of dollars of debt on companies that couldn't otherwise, in a normal interest rate environment, ever possibly afford it, but they could, given the essentially zero rate. And now we've gone from that to whatever it is now, 5%. And lo and behold, the demons, as you say, are coming screaming out of the box. Obviously, commercial property is one where we see it every day. But bankruptcies, my daughter is a bankruptcy attorney, and she's going to be very busy for a very long time. And then the question is, okay, well, who cares if XYZ real estate company goes out of business, or this energy company goes out? It doesn't matter. They just reorganize and away we go. But the problem isn't that. The problem is contagion. We don't know how much of that has been packaged into an asset-backed security. There's just this whole other life of derivative products and bonds that we don't know. And we see it with the property crisis in China. You say to yourself, this is the easiest problem in the world to fix for China. you just bring the big bazooka and get Evergrande, just eat it, right? Eat all the debt and then everything will be fine. And for 3 years, they haven't done that. And you said, you know, Xi is doing, everybody has a different idea of why Xi hasn't done that. And what I think is that he can't do it because of the contagion effect, that there will be a seizure in the financial system if they do do it. So they have to carry it on and on and on and on rather than risk the seizure. And I think what you said is, I think is exactly true with all this stuff that's going to come bubbling up, and this company is going to go bankrupt and this fund is going to go under, and it's going to feel very Bear Stearns 2007. And the question that we don't know the answer to is how much of that is tied to something else that we don't know about. And that's the thing that's terrifying. I'm fairly certain that's going to happen. And I think it will happen in the next 2 years. And that's why I think alternative investing, alternative finance, if you will, is going to become a major political issue.
You've tried to do this through your work pre being out on your own. But how do we go about helping people understand this? Because I co-founded a company called Real Vision about almost a decade ago now. And the idea there was very much to try and help ordinary people understand the world of finance better. And, you know, there are, as we found out, plenty of people who are interested in understanding it better. And I remember having a conversation with a guy we were trying to get to join us who worked at Saatchi & Saatchi, a lovely guy. And we were trying to get him to come across and help us with our creative stuff. And, you know, he asked me a perfectly simple question, that why would I leave this to go and work in finance? I know nothing about finance. Why would I do that? And we've been sitting at a railway station in London having a chat over a cup of coffee for, it was supposed to be half an hour. We probably ended up there for a couple of hours. And I said to him, look, how many people do you think have walked past us in the last 2 hours? It was a busy London station. We said, maybe 10,000 people have walked past us in 2 hours here. I said, what we are doing, what we're talking about finance here, impacts every single one of those 10,000 people. And maybe one in a few hundred understands that. And that's why this is important, because it does impact every single person's lives. And we got a hint of that in 2008. But since then, like the near miss, when you slam your brakes on in a car, your heart's pounding for a few blocks. And everyone seems to have forgotten it again now because times have been good and money's been free. How do we, as people publishing in a media business, how do we help people understand just how important, just how pervasive, and just how precarious this whole thing is?
Well, I think it starts with some financial backing that can put together essentially a, in the same way that Michael Sandel did that series of lectures when he was at Harvard on justice that became watched by literally millions of people around the world, something like that would have to occur. The people available to do that, and you could do it in Cambridge, Massachusetts, you just, people from MIT and Harvard would provide the quote content end quote. Really, the only difficulty would be finding the money, number one, finding a financial backer, and then two, making sure that it was promoted so that every single person in the world basically knew that it was available on the web.
But why is it you think that basic finance, basic understanding of the financial system is not taught in school anywhere? I mean, this is not an American problem. I wasn't taught it in the UK. It's not taught in Australia. It's not taught in Canada. Why do you think that is? It seems such a basic omission.
It is a basic omission, and I have no idea why. When I look back at my education, the thing that would have been most useful and most helpful to me in my 20s, 30s, and 40s was understanding finance. And the fact that I went to very good schools and the subject never came up. So. On the other hand, I could have taken economics in college. I mean, that was a choice that I could have made, but I didn't.
But it surprised me that finance is always an elective. It's never part of any kind of core curriculum, when everybody that leaves school is going to have to balance a checkbook and is going to have to take on debt and understand what that means. But no one's taught that. I'm conscious of the time, and I want to shift gears to the geopolitical side of your letter, because obviously that's another subject you cover. And boy, did you pick a good time to start covering geopolitics. As you look around the world now, we could zero in on any one of a number of geopolitical hotspots. Is there one which to you perhaps stands out as the one that really should be getting the bulk of our focus and perhaps isn't from a lot of people?
Well, I think the rise of China and the evident decline of Pax Americana, if you will, is the major story, is the lead story of our time. The sub-stories are climate change driving migration and food security and so on and so forth. That's a huge story. The separation of haves and have-nots in terms of science and technology, that's a huge story. The Middle East is a story that I don't really understand. I don't understand what that's going to mean 10 years from now, 20 years from now. I assume it's going to mean what it means today, but I'm not smart enough to figure that out. Russia is doomed, so it's going to be a real problem all the way to its ultimate demise. And the rise of India, obviously, is an important story. The thing that's really troubling about the next 20, 30 years is that non-state actors, we've always dealt in a world where you've had, you know, diplomats could talk to each other about killing each other or whatever. But now we have non-state actors who have access to technology that can create viruses, that can wipe out vast numbers of people, they can get their hands on weapons, that can kill vast numbers of people, and they are hard to find and hard to identify. That non-state actors are a huge part of a world in disarray.
Yeah, there's so many threads in there to pull on. And I'm going to pick your first one just for now, for the sake of time and expediency, because this idea of the demise of Pax Americana, that kind of pulls in so many of those other threats. And I think that's kind of central to rising powers elsewhere being able to challenge Pax Americana if it is in decline, as I agree it clearly is. But China is something that, as much as people see China as this great threat to America, there's no certainty that China is going to not implode at some point. There are all kinds of pressures internal on China. You know, the debt levels you've already alluded to in China are a significant problem. There's a sense that watching what's happening in the West right now, China would be better advised to kind of steward its resources and just sit back and wait for the West to do the job for it. How do you see that arc unfolding from here? The twin arcs, the rise of China, the demise of Pax Americana. How do you see that arc unfolding from here?
In the case of China, the strategy of wait and see, bide your time, don't move until they begin to give you more ground, that was the hallmark of the previous administrations, has been supplanted, obviously, by Xi's much more aggressive posture, which I think from the point of view of the rise of China is a really bad decision on Xi's part. I think wait and see, be patient, lurk, if you will, is a much better play for them. But I'm not Xi, and that's what Xi has done. So I think that the chances of China coming a cropper are much higher than they would be otherwise. I think the big thing about the demise or the decline of Pax Americana is that it opens up all imaginable opportunities for opportunists. So everybody from the Grand Mullah or the Ayatollah in Tehran to Vladimir Putin to Rocket Man in North Korea, I think back to after the first Gulf War, when Jim Baker came knocking on their door, the entire world was, you know, whatever you want, Jim, it's good with us, okay? Just don't put any of those missiles down our chimneys, okay? Because we're good. Whatever you want, we're good. And then you watch Tony Blinken, and I'm not being critical of Tony Blinken here. I'm just saying if you watch him hopscotch around the Middle East on the plane, the difference of being in command and trying to be in command could not be more stark. And Xi and Putin and the Ayatollah, it's not a conspiracy, but they're working in tandem to stretch out U.S. resources and essentially to make it impossible for us to resupply. And that's working remarkably well. China is flooding the U.S. with fentanyl. That's working remarkably well. China is flooding social media with TikTok. That's working remarkably well. So the opportunities that are opened up for opportunists by the decline of Pax Americana is probably the major day-to-day story of our time.
The two things you just said there about fentanyl and TikTok are objectively true. And yet people have a really hard time thinking that this could be deliberate action on the part of a state. They feel like it's circumstantial, it's happening. And when you start to talk about these as ideas, a lot of people just shut you down instantly and go, oh, you're a conspiracy theorist. It's just, you know, here we go again. Well, why do you think that is? What is the human failing that we have that makes conspiracy theories so abhorrent to most people that as soon as they get a whiff of something that might be, they instantly assume it is and shut down the conversation?
I don't know the answer. In the case of fentanyl, you have the precursor materials, if you will. You have the assembly, if you will, and then you have the distribution. So the precursor materials are in China. They're done by, we'll say, the equivalent of the Hell's Angels. And you and I both know that anything the Hell's Angels do in China is well known to Chinese security. No question about it. So they go to the port, they ship all this precursors over to Mexico. The cartels take the precursors, or Colombia, they take the precursors and they manufacture sheets and sheets and sheets of fentanyl, and then they put it into the cartel distribution system and it gets spread all across the United States of America. That's not a conspiracy theory. That's a fact. And it's a staggeringly awful problem. And it's essentially an attack on the people of the United States of America. And yet no one wants to talk about it. Your question is the right one. I just don't know why.
TikTok, it seems like such an innocuous beast. But again, it's, and I don't want to liken it to fentanyl simply because of the effects of fentanyl are so horrendous. But in terms of what TikTok is doing to the young versus fentanyl to the people who are sadly addicted to that drug, it's a very similar problem in terms of what it's doing to their attention spans, to their engagement in society, all these issues, which are generational in nature and are being inculcated at an age which is so dangerous for the future, not just of that generation, but also of the country. And it's still, people don't want to engage in that as a conversation. It's just, oh, it's just entertainment. It doesn't matter.
Yeah. My wife was telling me about an ad that she saw, and it was one of those incredible feel-good ads that just could not have been more treacly and touching every heartstring and so on and so forth. And she watched this and wondering, who is this? Who is this doing this? And it was TikTok. And my wife's view of TikTok is that it's basically a communist plot to destroy America. And it's amazing to me that knowing what we know now, if you went into the three major advertising holding companies in the United States of America and said, well, I have a client named TikTok, you know all about them, would you take their business? All of them would say they would.
Absolutely, without question. John, listen, we've run up against time, I'm afraid. I hate to end conversations like this, but I will ask you on the mic, and if you say no, I'm going to cut it out, if we could perhaps continue this conversation at a slightly later date, because it's just been fascinating and I feel like there's so much more we could talk about. So if you're open to the idea of coming back and continuing the conversation, I would love to do that.
I'd be delighted.
All right, well, let's do that. But in the meantime, before you go, just let people know more about News Items, where they can find you on Substack and stuff, because it's a terrific read.
News Items can be found at news-items.com. Or you can search substack.com for News Items. But the quickest way is to go to news-items.com. And that gives you access to subscribing to the newsletter, to the Political News Items newsletter, and to Bird News Items, which is a weekly and is free. We do News Items 6 days a week, Political Items 3 days a week, and Bird Items on Saturday.
Nobody is going to find a more high profile and better set of endorsements than the ones for your products and your sites. And John, thank you so much for spending this hour with me. I really, really appreciate it. And we will continue this conversation at a later date. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. Terrific.
Fantastic. All right. Enjoy the rest of your day, John. Thanks again.
Thank you so much.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, again, I apologize at the start of the show that we had to cut this one short, but I will absolutely follow through and make sure we get John back on the show, because there is so much more I want to dig into with him. His writing is extraordinary, and I would strongly suggest that you check it out. As I say, you'll find it at news-items.com, or you can look for John on Substack. Stuff he writes about is important. It's well written, it's impeccably sourced, and it's read by an awful lot of people who seem to know what they're doing. So I would suggest you follow them and look him up. That's it for me for another edition. I will be back again shortly with another guest. In the meantime, as always, thank you very much for listening.
Nothing we discussed should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets.